Well, good afternoon. Ah, friendly people. Stanley Hauerwas says, now, before I start, I have a problem with the zip in my trousers. And it seems to have a mind of its own, so if I'm constantly checking, it's not because I'm nervous, it's just because I don't want to offend anybody. Stanley Hauerwas says that English people are unfriendly. Clearly that's the case. He also said you were confrontational and aggressive, but I'm sure that's not the case either. Then. Put your hand up if you're English. Are you friendly?
Yes.
Confrontational?
Yes.
Aggressive?
Yes.
Lovely. No, it's a pleasure to be here at Greenbelt and to be able to spend some time talking about things that I hope will be of interest to you, and that I certainly have found interesting. Around this area of dementia, this is a Greenbelt lectern, by the way. Unusual. And what I want to talk to you about, obviously I want to talk to you today about dementia, but in reality, I'm talking about everybody. Because when you get into issues of dementia, a little bit like issues of disability, at first you think you're looking at one thing, and suddenly you think you're looking at everything. When you begin to look at dementia, you begin to see actually you're talking about and thinking about the way that all human beings are. So in that sense, anything that we talk about in relation to dementia has to do with what it means to be human. A few months ago, I was asked to do a Radio 4 program, and it was looking at dementia. And it had there were three speakers. There was myself, there was a Muslim psychiatrist from down south. Well, actually, this is down south, but from when I was north, it was south. And a Hindu psychiatrist as well. And we were all just talking about giving different perspectives on what dementia was. And right at the beginning of the interview, the interviewer said to us, I'm going to ask you a question at the end of your time, and I want you to be thinking about it so that three of you can give a different answer. And the question was, if you ever have dementia, how would you like to be treated? And it's really distracting when somebody, you're trying to keep track of a conversation, and at the same time, in the back of your mind, you're trying to think of something vaguely interesting or clever to say at the end of the thing. But when it came to my turn, I said something like, I hope to be recognized and treated for who I am, even if who I am is difficult and troublesome for some people. And when I said that, I thought that's quite interesting. Because who am I? You know, turn to the person next to you and say, who are you? It's very difficult to work out who you are. Who are you and why are you who you are? And oftentimes you are who you are because other people tell you you are, even if you don't recognize that that's a fact. So the question of who you are is fundamentally important for dementia in particular, where people arguably stop being the people they were before, and I say arguably for the reasons that I hope I'll be able to explain to you. So that question of who you are is going to underpin everything I want to talk about this morning. Dementia is obviously a neurological condition, although I'm going to raise some questions on that as we go on. But why is it that dementia is particularly problematic? And one of the reasons why it's problematic, apart from the obvious, is because the place that you encounter dementia profoundly impacts the way in which dementia is interpreted. So within our culture, the primary systems of value say, to be important, to be a citizen, to be a good person means that you have to have rationality, you have to have an individualness, you need to be able to function within the political system in a particular way. Indeed, the ability to know who you are and to participate as an individual in a society is really closely associated with the way that culture assumes human beings to be. And so your ability to participate, your ability to compete in the marketplace, your ability to have certain amounts of intellectual reason are assumed to be the essence of what it means to be normal. So within a society, to have a condition that takes away all of these things, or seems to take away all of these things, your rationale, your intellect, all these things, has a very particular meaning. And so there is always a danger that within our culture, because of the way our culture is constructed, dementia is particularly negatively understood. Now, the question that I want us to think about is, why do we think about dementia, difficult and horrible as it often is, why do we always think of the glass as half empty rather than as half full? I want to suggest it's something to do with the culture, something to do with the place we encounter dementia, And I want to begin to offer a theological perspective that maybe challenges some of the ways that we think. There's a really interesting neurologist called Oliver Sacks. I don't know if you guys have ever come across him. He's really fascinating. He's a neurologist who writes about his experiences with people with odd neurological conditions. One of his best books, in my humble opinion, and I don't have a humble opinion because I'm very full of myself, It's a book called A Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. And it's a series of stories about strange neurological conditions. But the one that I want us to think about just now is he talks about this guy called Jimmy, who's a mariner, or formerly was a mariner. The story is called The Ancient Mariner. And this guy called Jimmy G has Korsakoff's disease. The Korsakoff's disease is a form of dementia, or very similar to dementia, wherein through excess drinking over a long period of time, you begin to destroy these parts of your brain which relate to memory. And the primary symptom for Korsakoff's syndrome is acute loss of short-term memory. So Sacks would go into Jimmy's room in the place that he stayed, and they'd have a conversation for about 20 minutes. Jimmy would look out of the window and look back, and he'd say, "Oh, hey, Dr. Sacks, I haven't seen you for a long time. How are you?" No sense of anything apart from the present. He could remember things in a strange way before 1945, but nothing from 1945 through to the present could he remember. And no sense of the future, because what you remember at the past to some extent determines the way that you understand the future. So he was trapped in this eternal present. And Sacks described Jimmy as being de-souled. He thought there was something fundamental about the way that he was in the world that took his soul away, that made him somehow less than human. And Sacks, who is a secular Jew, so he wasn't looking at it from a religious point of view. He just used that language as describing something essential that was missing. But then one of the nurses said to him, "Watch Jimmy in worship." And he did. And he was amazed, because in that context of worship, when Jimmy participated in the sacrament, when he prayed, when he sang, there was no Korsakoff's. Only Jimmy locked into the spirit of the moment, locked into the experience of worship in a way that he wasn't at any other point in his life. Something particular happened to him. And Sacks changed his mind. Sacks, as a neurologist, had been taught to look at Jimmy in a very particular way, i.e. that his neurological condition determined what he was. After that incident, he realized that human beings are much more than memory alone. And something shifted, something changed. And I want to suggest that with dementia, there's a great danger that we allow the medical story, the medical narrative of neurological decline, loss of memory, and so on and so forth, to shape and form our understandings and our ideas in ways that are not helpful. And I want to suggest that perhaps if we look at things from a different angle, in a different frame, we'll see things differently. Because the way in which you perceive something determines the way in which you respond towards it. So it's no small deal to suggest that the way that we understand dementia, or the way we define and understand dementia, is fundamentally important. It's not a conceptual thing, it's actually a very practical thing. So I began by asking you the question, how do you know who you are? And I want to suggest that one of the ways in which we know who we are is through the stories that we tell about one another and the stories that are told about us. All of us, think about it, as soon as anybody asks you who you are, you'll tell them a story. You'll tell them a story about your past, you'll tell them a story about your present, you'll tell them a story about what you hope for the future. Our very selves are created by the stories that we tell about each other and the stories that are told about us. We're very much narrative beings. We can do very little without stories. And these stories move backwards and forwards across time, into history, into the future. They're always shifting and changing as we begin to form our identity. And there's a real sense that we know who we are by the relationships and the stories that we tell about one another. Now, normally that's a really interesting thing. Well, it's always an interesting thing. But normally that's a safe and neutral thing, because that's just what happens. But what happens when you can no longer tell your story well? When you can no longer defend yourself from stories that are negative, that are destructive? Who will tell your story well when you can't tell your story by yourself? It seems to me that that's one of the problems for people with advanced stages of dementia, is they can't tell their own story. But they still reside within stories, and they still have a story that needs to be told. And it's within that narrative framework that I want us to think about, because perhaps the way in which we can understand good ways of being with people who have severe dementia is to work through ways in which we can hold their story well, where we can encompass them and hold on to them in ways that they can't do themselves, and protect them from the kind of stories that are liable to do damage and harm. Now, the question then is, what kind of stories do we tell about dementia? What kind of stories do we tell? And when I say we, I just mean culture as well as you and I. But even in the language that we use, what kind of stories do we tell? There's an interesting emerging theory of role, a role theory within psychology, called positioning theory. Now, normally when you're talking about role theory, it means that you have a particular role within society. And so you're a father, a mother, a bus driver, whatever you may be, that's the role that you have within society. Now, of course, being a father, a mother, or a bus driver doesn't tell you very much about who you are as an individual. Positioning theory says, well, you may have certain roles within society, but what do these roles actually mean? And what it teaches us is that listen to the language that people use about particular things, and you will see the way that they're positioned within society, positioned within the situation. So, for example, if a woman comes to you, this is my husband. He has Alzheimer's. Now, that's not the normal way in which you describe your husband. That's not the normal role that a husband has within society. What happens with this man, he's lost his traditional role as a husband, with all that goes with that, and now he is an Alzheimer's suffering. And that's captured linguistically in the way that people, the language that his wife in this case uses to describe him. My husband, he has Alzheimer's. My husband, he is an Alzheimer's sufferer. And that language, think about your own language, actually, when you're talking about not just dementia, but anything. How do you position people in the way that you talk about them? Because the way that you position them will determine the way that you respond to them. So these are two ideas that I want you to keep in mind. The idea that we need to hold people in a particular story in order to have their identity. And second, to think about the way in which people with dementia are positioned in a language and positioned within our society. So what stories do we tell about dementia? Let's think about some of the stories that we tell about dementia. The big narrative, if you like, the grand narrative about dementia is it's a neurological condition. Now, you might say, well, that's obviously unarguable. Dementia has to do with neurological decline, which leads to lack of memory, which leads to a loss of sense of self, and so on and so forth. But the problem with that, if you like, that standard account of dementia is that it forgets or omits that there's a profoundly important social dimension to dementia that is not only important in terms of pastoral care, but may even be important in terms of neurology and neurological decline. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. There's a very interesting psychologist who sadly is now dead called Tom Kitwood, who worked in set up the Bradford Dementia Unit. And he was one of the pioneers in person-centered dementia care. And he has a theory about the way that dementia works itself out. He begins by looking at the way in which the brain forms. Now, this is your neurology lesson. Now, if there's any neurologists here, don't give me too much of a hard time, but just stick with me. And he notices that the way in which the brain forms is quite different from the way in which your nails form or your hair forms, or doesn't form in my case, or any other part of your body grows in that sense. Your brain grows in response to the experiences that it has. So every time you have an experience, for example, if I'm touching and picking up this watch, It's registered in the neurons and the synapses of my brain and becomes part of the structure of my brain, which is why, for example, when sometimes you see these horrible cases of children that are locked away in cupboards for years and years and years and then discovered and released, and they can't talk. And the reason they can't talk, and obviously can't interrelate, but the reason they can't talk is because that part of their brain which relates to speech requires people to speak to them. And so constantly your brain and all the functions of your brain require people to participate in that in a conversation, in a relationship with them. And as you do that, so your brain grows and develops. Now, Kipwood argues that even when you're in a situation where you begin to have that neurological decline, there's still possibilities for tapping into neurological resources. And he says something like this. He says, you could divide your brain into three bits. There's the kind of basic capacity that your brain has, which is the maximum that you're ever going to be able to do, as determined by genetics and biology. Then there's the capacity that you actually use. And for most of us, that's not the whole of our brain. I'm a teacher, I understand. And so even for everybody, there's a good deal of their brain that they actually don't use, that they underuse and they don't utilize. So there's even the possibility of stimulating that unused aspect, even in the midst of difficult neurological decline. But his main point is that in terms of social relationships, it may be that there's a relationship between the way that people with dementia are treated in society and the specifics of the neurological decline. And he talks about pathological social processes. He says, as soon as you get the diagnosis of dementia, what happens is people begin to treat you in a particular way. They begin to have certain assumptions about what you can and cannot do, and they'll treat you accordingly. They begin to have what you describe as a malignant social psychology develops, whereby people respond abnormally to this individual on the basis of their diagnosis. So as soon as you have a diagnosis of dementia, people will respond differently with this malignant social psychology. And his point is, whether it's right, whether it's wrong, is that actually in that context, social relationships may contribute to neurological decline. And the way that he begins to develop that argument is he looks at cases of what he describes as rementia, situations where people are able to claim back, if you like, certain attributes and aspects of their lives that they seem to have lost in a different social context, but were able to reclaim in the midst of, even in the midst of the difficulties that they're having. So, for example, I remember I used to be a hospital chaplain 20-odd years ago. And I remember going into what were then called dementia wards. And in dementia wards, people would sit around all day, just a bit like you guys, except they're a bit more animated, a bit more interesting looking. And they'd watch Postman Pat or kids' cartoons. And they'd sit there all day and they'd do nothing at all. But change that environment, go and speak to that person, or go and spend some time praying with that person, and things shift. Things change, a different perspective begins to emerge as you have different expectations of them. Kipwood says if you change the environment, change your perspective on the way that people interact, then that malignant social psychology is overcome and you'll be surprised what you can and can't see. I have a friend, give me another example. I have a friend who's just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's and has recently been taken into care. And just before he went into care, my wife was having a meal with him. And around the table, there was him, his family, and some of his key friends. It was like people he used to go fishing with, people he used to drink whiskey with, because he liked to drink whiskey. Not that I do, of course, I think that's an awful thing. I pray for him incessantly. And what she noticed was that these were the kind of closest people in his life. And they were talking about him, and they were talking across him, but they really weren't engaging in talking to him. And that caused him to withdraw. His withdrawal seemed to be framed as part of his condition, so therefore people continued to talk about him, talk across him, talk through him. And so eventually he became alone in a crowd of the people that were the closest to him. And when you look at the research around dementia, you see that's exactly what happens. People's friendships just drop off and drop off. Sometimes they're because they're a little bit older and because they die, but sometimes people just don't want to be reminded of what dementia reminds them to. So they withdraw, and so they take their friendships back. It's like middle-class friendships are just not designed for that kind of sea of turmoil that dementia is. And the person eventually becomes alone, isolated, and withdrawn. And then, of course, people around them say, well, this person's alone, isolated, and withdrawn. It must be because of the condition, and so on and so forth. And so you see the idea of malignant social psychology. Whether it does impact neurology, it certainly impacts the social context within which you experience dementia. So yes, dementia is a neurological condition, but it's not nothing but a neurological condition. And there's something fundamentally important about community and the place where you experience dementia. So the second big story that you might want to tell about dementia is a problem of memory. Now that seems obvious, because one of the primary symptoms of dementia is forgetfulness. So clearly it's a problem of memory. But then I ask you, where is your memory? Where is your memory? There's a fascinating book by Lisa Genova, which is it's a fictional novel about a Harvard professor who experiences Alzheimer's. And she really tells a fascinating story all the way through, right into her descent into, as she puts it, into Alzheimer's. And she uses her BlackBerry as a place to remember. So when she's beginning to forget, she uses a BlackBerry as a place. So every half an hour, the BlackBerry goes off and tells her to remember this, to remember that. And eventually that stops because she puts her BlackBerry in the freezer and forgets about it. And of course, in the context of the book, that's a marking point. She moves to a different place. But actually, you know, your memory's all over the place. Your memory's with your friends. Your memory's with notes when you take them. Your memory's on your computer. Memory is a corporate thing. It seems to be located somewhere in our minds, but actually when you think about it, it's all over. Even the simple act of tying a knot in your hanky to remind you something is an aspect of your mind, an aspect of memory. So certainly, dementia is a problem of memory, but memory is never located simply within an individual for any of us. It just looks that way. Memories reside in the stories that we tell about ourselves. Memories reside in the stories that tell about one another. My colleague, Margaret Hutchison, who's a nurse from Adelaide in Australia, told me this story about a woman in what at that time was called the dementia ward, who was very passive, very friendly, and who suddenly changed, who suddenly became agitated and anxious and began to walk up and down the ward, repeating the same word over and over and over again. Now, the ward team got together, and they talked it through, and they discussed, well, should we medicate her? Should we restrain her? How should we go about coping with this radically new development? Clearly, it's part of her condition, was the general thrust. But eventually, one nurse got alongside her and began to walk alongside her and began to listen to her. And the word that she was repeating again and again and again was the word God. God, 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 God. And suddenly the nurse reframed the situation and began to lock into what was going on. And she said to the woman, are you afraid that you're going to forget God? And the woman stopped there and she said, that's it exactly. I'm afraid I'm going to forget God. I've been a Christian all my life and I'm afraid I'm going to forget God. And the nurse said to her, you will forget God, but God will never forget you. And that behavior stopped, and she became calm, and she became peaceful. So there's something fundamentally important when we think about memory, that even though we may lose our memory, that doesn't mean we're forgotten. It doesn't mean we're forgotten by the stories that you and I tell about the person, and it clearly, as I've returned to at the end of this presentation, doesn't mean that we're forgotten by God. So memory is not what we think it is. It's something even more interesting, and in some senses, even more challenging. So is memory a problem of the mind? The next big story we might say is that dementia, rather, is a problem of the mind. You know, when you begin to read through some of the research and conversational literature, you're struck by some of the ways in which people are positioned, the language that people use. You get language of zombie, language of de-souled, language that somehow the person has disappeared from the, from their body, and their mind has gone. People frequently use that word, their mind has gone. But think about it. What exactly do we mean by mind? How do I know, when I look at you all, how do I know that you've got a mind? Look at the person next to you and say, and work out, how do you know that they've got a mind? Well, you don't know. You take it as an act of faith that somehow they have a mind. And constantly, we're engaged in this strange process of mind reading. You know, for me to engage with you or engage with anybody at all, I've got somehow to read your mind. I've got to work out more or less what I think you're thinking, and then I've got to respond accordingly to what I think you might be thinking. And constantly we're reading each other's minds, and I'm trying to work out what you're thinking, whether you're really bored or whether you're really interested. And so I'd make a decision and say, well, you're really interested because it makes life much more straightforward for me. And so when we say a person's lost their mind, how do you know? Because you don't know whether the person in front of you has a mind at the best of times, so why would you suddenly make an assumption that a person with dementia has lost their mind? And the reason that you suddenly make that assumption is because you're taught to do that. Because we're taught that mind equals certain forms of neurological function. If we're told that these neurological functions don't work in the ways that we assume them to be, then mind can't be present. A mind is an act of faith. For me to believe you've got a mind, I have to have faith in you. For me to believe a person with dementia has a mind, I have to have faith in them. And mind, like memory, if memory is a corporate thing that we're sharing together, mind's the same in an odd way. Constantly we get our understanding of mind from other places. Take something like psychotherapy or counseling, and I don't want to offend any psychotherapists or counselors here, but what do you do in a counseling or psychotherapy situation? You give the counselor your mind, they tell you what it is, they give it back to you. And if you don't believe them, they'll tell you you're in denial. But it is, isn't it? I mean, you're constantly being told what the right way to think, what the right way for that which is within you from that which is outside of you. So mind is under common ownership in a very real sense. Mind is a social thing, yes. It's something that belongs to an individual thing, rather. It's something that belongs to me. But it's something that is fed, that all the images, all the ideas, all everything that I have, my mind comes from the place I am. And ultimately, and this is fundamentally important, to believe that another person has a mind in whatever way you want to frame that is an act of faith and an act of hope and a possibility of something different. Let me read this little quotation to you from a fascinating paper by Jaber Gubrium. It's called The Social Preservation of Minds. And he talks about the way in which a person with Alzheimer's mind is preserved within the community that they're in. And this is a woman whose husband has significant Alzheimer's. And she says this: "How do you really know his mind has gone? You don't really know for sure, do you? You don't really know if those little plaques and tangles are in there, do you? How do I know that the poor man isn't hidden somewhere behind all that confusion, trying to reach out and say, 'I love you, Sarah,' and she weeps?" Now, it seems to me that that's a really touching example of someone who's prepared to give the person in front of them the benefit of the doubt, who's prepared to offer the possibility of faith and hope, even when those around her are not prepared to do the same thing. And I think there's something really important in there about the way in which we are with people who have particularly advanced Alzheimer's. It's something to do with giving people the benefit of the doubt. It's something to do with having faith. If faith is being sure of what you hope for and certain of what you cannot see, as the writer to the Hebrews says, then there's something about that as a way of being with a person. And that's not to say, I don't mean that idealistically. I just mean that in terms of the way in which we sit with people, maybe we need to shift our understanding. Maybe we need to shift our understanding of what faith and hope and love might be. And when you think about it like that, and when you think about the way in which we need to hold on to the person with dementia, through remembering well, through the stories that we tell. We're kind of taken back to that idea from African Ubuntu theology. Within our society, we tend to think of ourselves as individuals. I think, therefore I am, as Descartes went. In other words, because as long as I've got rational cognition, as long as I have self-awareness, I am who I am. African Ubuntu theology says something quite different. It says we relate, therefore we are. The basic assumption being that I am because you are. We are because we are together. That I can only become the person I am because I enter into relationships with other people. I can't be anything without other people. And that's the case for everybody. It may be brought into sharp focus with people with dementia, but really what we learn there is that we are who we are because of who we are together. I think that's a really important place for us to begin to think about. We are just in the process of finishing off a project looking at the spiritual lives of people with profound and complex intellectual disabilities. And interesting, in a different way, many of the issues that we come across in relation to dementia theologically work themselves out in a similar way in the lives of people who don't have language, who don't have cognition in the way that we normally expect that to be. And we're going around various congregations and spending time with families of children and adults who have profound intellectual disabilities. And we've been working with one young lady who is in a Quaker community. And there's two stories I'll tell you about it. And this, although she doesn't have dementia, obviously, this will relate very closely to who I want to go as I come to the end of what I want to say. Two stories about Sandra. She's blind, almost deaf, and she's completely immobilized, spends most of her time lying on the ground. She's able to communicate through noises and through sounds, but she doesn't use words. But recently, she has been diagnosed as having leukemia. And our mum told us a story that she went into her room in the hospital and said to her, Sandra, you've got leukemia. And Sandra immediately burst into tears. Now, how do you understand that? She doesn't have the conceptual language to understand the word leukemia, but clearly something happened when her mother came to give her this particular news. Second story. As part of our research, we spent a lot of time just being with people and working out how they communicate and what their spiritual traditions mean. And of course, within the Quaker tradition, silence is fundamentally important. And in the main meeting, the main research meeting that we had, people were saying, well, Sandra, when she gets into this context of silence, she at first becomes noisy, but then settles in. We'll show you, they said. So the Quakers gathered round, and they went into this time of silence. And sure enough, Sandra at first was really noisy, but then eventually as the silence broke, if you like, across the room, she sank into it. And she clearly participated in a meaningful sense in the silence of the moment. Now, how do these two stories relate to one another? Well, it seems to me that more than probably Sandra wouldn't understand the idea of leukemia, but something happened. What she did understand was the experiences and the emotions of her mother. Something of these experiences, in this case sadness, transmitted to her, even though she didn't have the language to do that. What happened in the Quaker movement was something very similar. Although she didn't have the cognition, as far as I know, to be able to understand what was going on, she was able to feel and experience the silence through the feelings and experiences of those around her. In other words, her spirituality is corporate. It's something to do, and it's corporate and experiential, something to do with being in a situation where she is able to lock into the feelings of the person around her and enter into the spirit of the moment through their experiences, their love, and their desire to be part of that community. In other words, her spirituality was non-cognitive, but it was located and dependent on those around her. I think that's really, really important because we do tend to think that spirituality is something we have, and so therefore if a person loses their cognition, then that's it. They can't have spirituality or whatever way you want to frame that. But if the spirituality belongs to the community, and if it's something to do with experience and relationship, then everything changes. I was listening to iTunes U. I don't know if you ever listened to iTunes University. If you don't, I don't blame you, because some of it's very, very boring, and I'm a very boring person. I don't sleep very well, so I get up in the middle of the night and listen to iTunes U, and that's very sad, really, isn't it? You're laughing at me. It's not kind. But I was listening to this biblical scholar called John Goldingay, who's an Old Testament scholar at Fuller. And he, before he started his lecture, he invited the whole class to come to his house for pancakes. It must have been pancake day, I think that's what he called it. And he said his wife has had, at that time, sadly she's dead now, had very severe multiple sclerosis. And he said to the class, come, we're going to have pancakes, it'll be a nice time together. You can sit with my wife, and please speak to her. And he said, she won't know you and she won't remember what you've said, but in that moment she'll appreciate it. And it just suddenly struck me that in that moment she'll appreciate it was perhaps a key. It's the sacrament of the present moment that's fundamentally important when we're talking about, when we're spending time with people with severe dementia or severe cognitive disabilities. It's the ability to be in the moment. Now, the way that we tell our stories and live our lives is a very particular understanding of time. We use time like a commodity. We waste time, we buy time, we sell time, we use time. And time is always rushing on. I'm always 20 minutes ahead of myself in almost everything I do. But what he was saying was, it's a moment that's significant. And that takes you right back to the spiritual traditions and the contemplatives. The contemplatives did everything that they could to get past their rationality. They would go out into the desert, they'd stand on pillars, they would do everything to become undistracted, if there's such a word, in order that they can get past their reason, past their intellect, and simply have an experience where they learn how to love God simply for God's sake. Not for what God will do for them or what they want from God, but to love God simply for God's sake. Why? Because that's precisely the way that God loves them. Not for what they have, not what they don't have, not for what they might have, but because that's just what God does. And it seems to me that the idea of the sacrament of the present moment is fundamentally important. To be able to learn to see God in every moment, in every encounter, in every aspect of somebody's life, takes something different. It takes you a different perspective on time. It takes you to a different perspective on rationality. It takes you to a different perspective on how you should be with somebody. Not just a person with dementia, but with all of us. To be able to learn to respect the sacrament of the present moment is fundamentally important for the types of communities that we're called to create as Christians. Now, all of that is interesting, all of that is helpful, but one of the, just come towards the end of what I'm going to say, because we're kind of running out of time. One of the interesting questions, and this relates to the question of who you are, has to do with the soul. One of the interesting things that we notice is, because one way you could frame dementia is say, well, everybody has a fundamental soul that then is continued into eternity, or however you want to frame it. But one of the interesting things about contemporary neurology is it seems to be shown that many of the attributes of the soul, the ability to love God, to have faith, to have intellectual capacity, and so on and so forth, are actually proven to be aspects of the brain. And so what happens to the soul in the midst of all of that? Are we just to reject the idea of the soul, or is there a different way that we can think about the soul that will enable us to understand what the future hope is for people with dementia, as well as the present hope in the present moment? Let me read you some things. So I want to think back to that lady's May's story about being remembered by God. Because it seems to me that the essence of what we mean when we use the language of soul in relation to dementia or anything else is to be remembered by God. So let me read this to you. I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget. Soul theologically names the me that God sees and remembers. Now think about it this way. Are you the same person that you were 20 years ago? Because I'm not. I don't think the same way. My body has shed so many different cells that I'm probably a very physically different person. So how do I really know who I am? And when I think back and I tell my own stories and I tell my own perspectives on the way that my life is, how do I know they're true? Because I'm always retelling my story. I'm always making up my story. The reality is that none of us really know who we are. We have fleeting glimpses of who we are. We have fleeting glimpses of who we think we are. But the reality is none of us really know who we are. Only God knows and remembers who you are. There is a sense in which on that great day when we stand before God in judgment, then we'll know who we are. Then the story will be told properly, because the only person that knows the story of our lives is God. Until then, it's all going to be fragmented. It's not just a thing about dementia, it's for all of us. So the soul theologically aims the me that God sees and remembers. And this is the direct bearing, not only in my endurance after death and my identity when I have dementia, but in every moment. Every moment, only God really knows who we are. So the point is that God always knows who we are, and we're always only partially understanding who we are. So the best that dementia does is reminds us of our own confusion about who we are. So there's nothing qualitatively different about people with dementia in terms of forgetting who they are, because none of us really know who we are beyond that. So if the soul equals endurance, that ongoing perspective of who we are, only God can assure that not any quality of my being. So it's not what I know or don't know. It's only what God knows and remembers. And it's very clear to me that when we talk about resurrection, that what resurrection will be at a minimum is us seeing who we are in embodied form, seeing who we really are. There's a fascinating book by Christine Bowden called Who Will I Be When I Die? And she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when she was in her early 50s. And the book's all about the way of her change of identity. But that question, who will I be when I die, is very, very important, because it worries us sometimes. It troubles us when we've lost that. But the truth is that theologically speaking, God will remember us in all of our fullness in a way that we don't even know ourselves just now. And when we come to be resurrected, God will remember us and we will see ourselves for who we are for the first time. For now, we're called to be with one another, and to be with one another in the present moment, and to recognize the significance of what it means to be with one another as we're learning who we are, even when we're forgetting who we are. And I think it's really, really important. There's nothing qualitatively different about dementia. It just reminds us of something that we all go through, we all endure. And so finally, a key thing might be that when it comes to people with dementia and all at different stages, maybe we should give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe we shouldn't necessarily simply believe the neurological stories that were told, or the cultural stories that were told, or the stories about memory that were told. Maybe we should challenge that, and maybe particularly as Christians, we should challenge that. And we should recognize that there are different ways of telling stories, different stories to be told, and to help people to see that the story of the moment, not the story of what might happen, what has happened, the story of the moment, might actually be the place of meeting for you and people who other people have forgotten about. Because the ironic thing about dementia is it brings about a horrible forgetfulness from society and from those around it. So that which is forgotten brings about forgetfulness. So when I spoke on that radio program, I said something like, I hope that I'll be loved and cared for just for who I am, even if who I am is difficult for me and for others. And that took me on the journey that I've kind of shared with you a little bit. I hope that I will be loved. Maybe one of you guys in this room will be caring for me when I'm old and I have dementia. I don't see any willing volunteers. That's not good. But if you are, I want you to tell the right stories about me. I want you to remember me well. And I want you to remember that you have my memory, that you are my story, and that I need you, and perhaps even that you need me. And I want you to help me not to forget that God is with me in that sacrament of the present moment. And I want you to help me not to forget, because I want you to be God's representative. I want you to be the one that reminds me that even when I can't remember myself. And I think maybe if we can do that, and maybe if Christians can model that, then maybe dementia will be a lot less frightening for the future than it is at the moment. Thank you very much for listening. I think we've got 5 minutes. Five minutes for questions. If anybody's got anything that's burning on them, 2 minutes. 2 minutes for questions. Oh no! Hang on.
I just wanted to say something about your mention of people's stories. My experience of being a mental health service user is that I had OCD for a long time, obsessive compulsive disorder with ruminating thoughts. And basically, I said that's why I agreed with that, because I didn't want to suggest that the thoughts that were in my mind weren't to do with me, which in that case would become voices. And it was only when I decided that I had to, after two suicide attempts in a week, I decided I had to take matters into my own hands and get better myself, that I realized there's no point in identifying with what's going on in my mind, because that was hurting me, and if I didn't want it, then why identify with it? But the minute I do that, then what happens is that psychiatry would then say that I'm hearing voices rather than having OCD. So therefore, it gets worse. And then, you know, the idea is to medicate away these thoughts, which they call voices, and basically the only way out of it is to become more sane than anyone else in order to escape the system. Do you think this is a right way of treating people with... I very much doubt it, knowing a bit about your work, but I'd like to know your views on that kind of procedure, which is happening to hundreds of thousands of people over the country.
I think that's a very good question, because the kind of idea that I've been putting forward, that there are certain negative stories that are told about people that overpower them and become their whole identity, very much applies to mental health issues. I did some work in schizophrenia not so long ago, and that's precisely, once you have a label of schizophrenia, it becomes what you are. You know, if you have the cold, nobody says you are the cold. Nobody calls you influenza, but if you have schizophrenia, then you become a schizophrenic, whatever that may be, and it takes over the whole of your life. And so therefore, the kind of personal narratives and the way in which you're interpreting your behavior is overwhelmed by bigger stories that seek to explain it. So I do agree with you that I think there's a lot of work to be done to listen to the type of story that you have and to allow that to challenge the bigger stories that try to explain your experience in different ways. Well, that's for a different session, but it's a very good question. I think the question should remain unanswered.
Thank you. It's in respect of how we relate to people who have got Alzheimer's. And there's, because of the person also gets a cognitive difficulty being able to process the communication, the way, not only is we may try to tell a story, but the way that we actually then have to put in such a simplified language that at worst often becomes baby talk, and even worse, it doesn't even talk to the person as well, that increases the social exclusion. I didn't know whether you had any comment. Well, maybe you've given us everything, which is really, really helpful. But the way that we continue to socially exclude and discriminate against somebody by the way that we become to them. But in the act of communicating and doing something differently than how I might say, for example, putting the question to you, we put ourselves into a different process than otherwise we might be. And because the person can't communicate back in an intelligible language, we then don't get the feedback as to how we then channel. And so the communication is challenged, but then we've still got to overcome it in order not to continue to socially exclude the person through our changed way of being. I mean, I suppose I'm speaking simply now, so I was just thinking, answering my own question. Well, I can still speak maturely to my father, in actual fact. But I resort to another way of speaking, and so do it. It changes my own mental processes. So I don't have any comments on the way that we can check our own behaviours that have to be a little bit different because we're not getting the same signals back or the same. We have to put it over in a more simplified way.
Yeah. No, I think you did answer your own question. I think what you said was absolutely right. But I guess, and the danger is, it's a difficult one to get past, that you end up creating a false story for the individual because as you say, you don't get the feedback, so therefore you don't get a checks and balances in what you're saying, so therefore you can end up with that. But I guess that's just patience and perseverance, and recognizing that you will get it wrong. But at the same time, giving the person the benefit of the doubt, insofar as that they're probably understanding more than you think they are, but you need to communicate in a way that will communicate. Yeah. But you will get it wrong. I mean, how could you not? But you do anyway. Yeah. And you're smiling at me. You could be thinking anything.
I was in a cafe not so long ago, and there was only two other people in. One was a carer, another person had dementia. She was trying to engage him in conversation unsuccessfully. Then he began to sing, and she left him to go to the toilet, and he sang again. And it turned out he'd been in a choir when he was younger, and I read something recently that said that singing is one of the ways that people will communicate, sort of mood music. I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
There's an interesting study done in Sweden that came out this last year looking at whether or not nurses singing to people with dementia was therapeutic, and the general thrust of the paper was that it was. I imagine it depends on how good a singer you were. It could be you're kind of trapped there. but yeah, it's recognised that singing and the arts as well are ways of communicating effectively with people that now have to communicate in a way that they didn't before.
The primary social relationship that most of us live in is that of marriage. And when one or other partner is suffering dementia, then what is good for one of the partners is not necessarily good for the other, and often can be in direct conflict. That creates terrible difficulties in working out who's trying to help who and how. Yeah. Is there anything you could say about that at all?
No, not really. other than yes. It is extraordinarily difficult in the midst of that, and it becomes even more complicated when one person is taken into care and the other person is not, and relationships develop in the care home and so on and so forth. These are important issues, but not something I'd want to comment on in 2 seconds, but I acknowledge the issue, definitely, or the complexity of the issue.
Just like to reflect on what you were saying earlier about the importance of language. My experience is my wife has multiple sclerosis, and I resist people describing her as an MS sufferer, much worse, a victim of MS, and prefer to talk about her living with MS or being someone who has MS. She suffers, she has MS, but her life is primarily about life, not those other things. And thank you for what you said, because I believe language that we use, we think superficially, casually, that doesn't matter, can actually have a very big impact, either positively or negatively, and thank you for the reminder of that.
Yeah, it's very important. That's great. Well, I think that's us, time-wise. Great. Well, thank you very much.